We are continuing our look at the Book of Wisdom, and we have a nice internet working here in the library. They have a new internet here, so they gave us the new instructions for it and everything, so that was good. So we are on chapter 3 of the Book of Wisdom, and Chiara is now joining us.
Tina's coming too.
Hi, Chiara.
Good morning.
Good morning. We're just getting started. Chapter 3 of the Book of Wisdom.
Thank you.
And so in chapter 3, it's going to talk about the destiny of the people who are righteous and the people who are ungodly. What can we say about what's going to happen to them, their destiny? And they have some interesting little notes here. They say this passage, it talks about chapter 3 through chapter 4, verse 20. So that whole section, it's got some interesting little notes on it. It says, this whole passage describes at some length the contrasting situations of the righteous and the ungodly in life, in death, and beyond the grave. So it's not just talking about what's going to happen to them here on earth. It's what's going to happen to them forever. So it's got an eschatological kind of tone to it. The author has consoling things to say to the righteous as regards afflictions. They have every reason to hope. He talks about the righteous. He says no torment will ever touch them, but he's really talking about the afterlife, because we know we're going to have sufferings in this life. So that's not a thing there. But he says, the author has consoling things to say. They have every reason to hope.
I didn't know it was in here. I went to the other place.
Yeah. Oh, you're not on email, are you?
I was absent last Monday.
So oh, I yeah. said to you at church, are you going to the library? And you said yes.
Oh, I thought you said you're going to the Bible study.
Yeah.
And you have a soft voice, and I don't hear so well.
Yeah, we had to change to here because the internet was not working in the other place.
Okay. Got your exercise this morning.
So, but he says they have every reason. The righteous have every reason to hope because they're going to go to heaven and have happiness for eternity. But evildoers, he describes as foolish. Theirs is a fundamental error, which will cause them grief now. Any sufferings they experience will do them no good. You know, Jesus always says, "When you have sufferings, offer it up to me, and I'll unite it to my suffering." And his suffering only has one purpose, redemption of mankind. So when we suffer and we offer our suffering to Jesus and say, united to yours, he's giving us the opportunity to participate in his redemptive suffering. So our suffering helps with the redemption of other people. He doesn't have to do this. I mean, his is sufficient, but he lets us do that because he loves us, which is really kind of an interesting thing when you think about it. Since their death is grievous, and so is what lies beyond it. So he's kind of saying, you know, if you're not righteous, you're kind of in a bad way all around. And then there's a quote here. What I'm reading is the notes that the authors of Navarre gave us. Okay. I'm not reading your Bible, so if you're trying to follow along,
right. Yeah.
So there's a quote here from St. Ignatius of Antioch. He says, and he's talking about the Book of Wisdom, so which means that the early church fathers accepted the Book of Wisdom, right? Okay. St. Ignatius of Antioch was, of course, a direct disciple of St. John the Evangelist, and he was a good friend of the Blessed Mother. We have a letter from him to her where he's planning to go visit, and he addresses the letter to Mary, ever virgin Mother of God. So he recognizes her perpetual virginity and that she is the Mother of God. And he just says, hey, I'm going to be in the neighborhood. I'm going to come by and see you. You know, that's basically all the letter says. But the way he addresses her in the letter is really important. So he says, he's talking about here the Book of Wisdom. Two possibilities are laid open to us at the same time, life and death. And each person will come to the end that befits him. Life and death are like two types of coin. One belongs to God and the other to this world, each with its own hallmark. Unbelievers deal in the currency of this world, and those who have remained faithful through love carry the coin of God the Father, which is marked with Jesus Christ. So you remember in the gospel where Jesus says, you know, give me a coin whose image is on a coin, it was Caesar. Well, Ignatius is kind of using that same idea and saying there are two kinds of coin. One has Caesar's image, the other has the image of Christ. And his coin is the kind we used to get to heaven, you know, to put in the slot, open the door, and get to heaven. If we are not ready to die for him or to imitate his passion, we will not have his life within us. So that's what St. Ignatius says. And then there's some specific notes on verses 1 through 9. That's the first section here. It says, these very poetic lines convey very well the notion of the reward that awaits the just in the afterlife. But they are not very specific about it. That's because we don't really know. You know, what does St. Paul say? He says, the mind of man has not conceived of what God has in store for those who love him. So he can't really tell you with specifics. But he says, whatever it is good. Okay. The author uses expressions that correspond to the time in history and revelation in which he lives, but they do enable us to get an idea of the state of the blessed. He says, the souls of the righteous are in the hands of God, and no torment will ever touch them. That is, in this sphere, the righteous dead are at peace. That is, in the sphere proper to God, they can be sure of immortality. They will abide in the kingdom of God forever and share in God's power to judge and rule. And this is the same thing that, you know, Matthew says in 19, a pointer to their power of intercession. It says they share in God's power to judge and rule, which is one of the first indications we see that they're actually going to do this. You know, in Revelation, it talks about this, but in the Old Testament, we don't really see much about the saints ruling and judging. But in Revelation, remember, it says that there'll be seats for the elders and the apostles. They will judge the tribes of Israel. And on the temple, there the stones of the tribes, and then the stones for the 12 apostles and all. So he's kind of given that entree there. So the power of intercession. So one could say that the most encouraging line of all is the faithful will abide with him in love. Still to come is the explicit. Sorry, I hear a lot of noise. Still to come is the explicit New Testament revelation, which tells us that the blessed shall see God as he is. And of course, John says that in his letter. Not as in a dull mirror, but face to face. They will know him as he knows them, and they will be with Christ forever in heaven. So that's the first notes on the first introduction to chapter 3. So now we'll go to chapter 3. It talks about the death of the righteous to begin with. What's going to happen when the righteous people pass on to the next world? It says, for the souls of the righteous are in the hand of God, and no torment will ever touch them. So they're with him. He's protecting them. You know, they belong to him. He's not going to let them suffer, not going to let them get away from him. In the eyes of the foolish, they seem to have died, and their departure was thought to be an affliction, and their going from us to be their destruction. But they are at peace, for though in the sight of men they were punished, their hope is full of immortality. In the sight of men, they're punished because everybody says, well, we want to live the longest life we possibly can. If you die early, you're being punished. But in God's eyes, that's not always the case. Look at all the saints who died when they were 33,
right.
You know?
No, it's a blessing.
So, he talks about that a little later, mm-hmm. that sometimes God will give you the reward he's got ready for you, mm-hmm. a little earlier than mm-hmm. otherwise, if you have lived a good life to that right. point. Mm-hmm. he'll snatch you up and say, "Okay, now it's time to get your reward. You know, get your popsicle. Here you go."
Before you change your mind.
it's always a danger that people could fall. You know, and so to keep you from doing that, he'll snatch you up and give you the reward now.
My cousin had a son, 8 years old, die unexpectedly. You know, it was a throat problem. He just collapsed at her feet. Mm-hmm. And the priest gave the sermon, and he said, you know, God knew this was the perfect time.
Right.
That's
right.
To go to heaven.
Yeah, that's true. He does things like that, you know. Mm-hmm. There was a priest that was confined to a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. Wow. And this lady who was kind of a mystic was always praying that he would cure this priest. And one day she was praying, and she said, she got mad at God. She said, "Why don't you cure this priest? I've been praying forever for this guy to be cured." And God talked to her. And he said, "If I cure him, he will lose his vocation. Yeah. The only way I can keep him a good priest is by keeping him in that chair." So God knows these things, you know. So he does these kinds of things. So we should never be really upset when those things happen, because God knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. You know? He knows better than we do what we're doing.
Besides, they're going to be deliriously happy. We forget that.
That's right.
And it's worth it. You know? I mean, what is the delirious eternity in heaven compared to something on earth?
That's right. You know, my son Mike, Father Mike, died. You know? He was only 54 years old.
Yeah.
Everybody said, "Oh, he was so young." The first thing that comes to my mind when I think about it is what Jesus said about John the Baptist. He said, "No man born a woman is greater than John the Baptist, but even the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." So he's a lot greater than I am right now. You know, so it makes me feel really good, you know. So I just look forward to when I'll see him again.
Exactly.
And at my age, it won't take too long, probably.
Yeah. We're one day closer, all of us.
Right. So who knows, you know. So he says, having been disciplined a little, they will receive great good. So he may send some suffering to us to help us do our purgatory on earth, you know, if nothing else. And we can offer that suffering back to him, like we talked about. He said, "For though in the sight of men they were punished, their hope is full of immortality. Having been disciplined a little, they will receive great good, because God tested them and found them worthy of himself. Like gold in the furnace, he tried them, and like a sacrificial burnt offering, he accepted them. In the time of their visitation, they will shine forth and will run like sparks through the stubble. They will govern nations and rule over peoples." Again, that's that idea that the saints are going to participate in that judgment of God. And that's one of the first places in Scripture we actually see that kind of a reference. "Those who trust in him will understand truth, and the faithful will abide with him in love, because grace and mercy are upon his elect, and he watches over his holy ones." The faithful will abide with him in love. And again, it's emphasizing the idea that we see so often from Jesus, that and in Paul's letters too, and in John's letters, you know, the one thing that always is the most important is love. Of all the theological virtues, that's the one that survives. The rest of them we don't need anymore, but we need love. Because God is love. And when I was reading, I was thinking too that, you know, people say, well, you hear people say all the time, "Well, you're probably going to go to hell." He said, "Well, so what? I'm going to go to hell, you know."
Yeah.
They think like it's no big deal, you know.
Yeah.
But they don't understand that hell was created for the devils, not for man. And it's a place where there is no love. You can't even love yourself in hell. So people say they're going to go there, going to be with all their friends, have fun.
Right.
Nobody's going to have fun.
No.
It's the most miserable existence you could think of.
Torture.
You know, it's total absence of God, which means total absence of love, because he is love. Oh, Elmer's joining us. Here he joins. Good morning, Elmer.
Good morning.
How are you?
Fine. Good to see you.
Yeah, we're welcome. Welcome. We're talking about the Book of Wisdom right now, and we're looking at chapter 3, and the different things it talks about, the destiny of those who are righteous and the destiny of those who are ungodly. And one of the things we were talking about just now was a passage that was written by St. Ignatius of Antioch. He was a direct disciple of John the Apostle, and he was a good friend of St. John's. And he was taken in chains to Rome to be martyred. And while he was on the way, he was able to write these letters. And in one of them, he's talking about the Book of Wisdom. And he says, two possibilities are laid open to us at the same time, life and death. And each person will come to the end that befits him. Life and death are like two types of coin. One belongs to God and the other to this world, each with its own hallmark. Unbelievers deal in the currency of this world, and those who have remained faithful through love carry the coin of God the Father, which is marked with Jesus Christ. If we are not ready to die for him or to imitate his passion, we will not have his life within us. So he's talking about this. He's referencing this chapter 3 of the Book of Wisdom here in his letter. And the chapter 3, as we were just going through it, talks about how some people look at people who are faithful to God, the righteous, and it says when they die, in the eyes of the foolish, they seem to have died, and their departure was thought to be an affliction, but they're actually go to heaven to be united with God forever. And so they're talking about that. And
welcome.
It says, for though in the sight of men they were punished, their hope is full of immortality. Having been disciplined a little, they will receive a great good, because God tested them and found them worthy of himself. Like gold in the furnace, he tried them, and like a sacrificial burnt offering, he accepted them. In the time of their visitation, they will shine forth, will run like sparks through the stubble. They will govern nations and rule over peoples. This is one of the first places in Scripture where we see that the faithful are going to actually judge the people. It talks about that in the book of Revelation, but this is one of the first places in the Old Testament where it actually talks about the faithful righteous of God judging people at the last judgment.
Yeah, we never hear very
never
much about that.
We never hear very much about that.
Everyone thought we'll all stand before God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's got kind of eschatological tone to it here. It says, those who trust in him will understand truth, and the faithful will abide with him in love, because grace and mercy are upon his elect, and he watches over his holy ones. So that's all talking about the people who are righteous, who love God, who are faithful to God, and then they die, and then what God does with them, protects them, and then gives them all the good things.
It seems like we should read this at funerals.
They do.
Oh, I guess I haven't.
Sometimes they do, yeah.
Very, very good. Yeah.
You haven't been through the last then.
So sometimes they'll do that, yeah.
I'm going to pick that one up.
And so that's kind of what we are always taught, that if we're faithful, if we're true to God, we follow him, we keep his word, that our reward will be great in heaven. You know, it's a gift of his. We can't say, well, I did the following three things, and then therefore I'm entitled to heaven. Nobody's entitled to it. You know, it's a gift of God through faith. So then it goes on, the next part, starting with verse 10, and it's talking about what is the fate of the ungodly, those who are not righteous. What's going to happen to them? And what I'm using is the Navarre Study Bible. And so it has the text at the top and then notes, study notes at the bottom. And
but this one's not enough.
There's a section from verse 10 through 19 that we're going to go through next. And they have some notes about that. So there is no question but that the ungodly will be punished. Their most serious fault is that they have turned away from the true God to follow the practices of idolatry. And we see over and over and over again what God thinks about idolatry. You know, he compares it to to adultery and everything else, you know. And it's just really terrible.
Idolatry is with other gods, right?
Right, yeah. It says, but their ill treatment of the righteous is another reason for their condemnation. So not only are they idolatrous, but they also look down upon those who are faithful to God. There may be, in these verses, a reference to the Hellenized Jews who were betraying their religion. Because in the diaspora, they got kind of sucked into the religions that were around them. The punishment for unfaithfulness and immoral conduct is described in general terms. Unhappiness, failure in life, useless suffering, etc. The ungodly are never happy. There is no hope on their horizon, no relief from their anguish. To compound their misfortunes, their family life will go awry. Their bad example would lead their wives to behave foolishly and their children to go astray. And of course, he's talking here about the husband's the head of the family. You give bad example to your family, that influences your wife and kids, and they go off and imitate you. This is rounded off by verses about the good fruits of chastity and the bad effects of adultery. Throughout, the references to the retribution that will come with the last judgment. Again, it's got that eschatological, you know, element to it. For the just, the fruits of good labor, the fruit of good labors, for adulterers, dishonor, and divine punishment. So God in the Old Testament oftentimes compares idolatry to adultery. He talks about Israel as you adulterous nation, you know, and this kind of stuff. And that's because the act of adultery is such a blow to trust, love, and fidelity.
But I always think it's interesting they were allowed so many wives at the time. So, but it was still wrong.
Well, that was custom, you know, back
right,
then.
Right, custom,
yeah.
So I mean...
Yeah.
Well, Moses, I think, said something about, I knew that your heart couldn't do this, so they did that at that time.
Well, divorce.
Divorce, I'm
yeah.
sorry.
Yeah. I mean,
sorry,
it seems funny to yeah. be adulterous when you have already 100 wives.
Right. Well, it yeah. sounds like they're... What's really being done here is the bond between God and us
right.
is much like the bond between our husband and
a good wife. One of the good ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's the way we want it to be, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's true.
Right?
And Jesus talks about when you go to heaven, it's the marriage feast of the Lamb. Mm-hmm. He uses a lot of the marital imagery in the relationship between man and God. So, and he talks about God being the spouse of our soul, and those kind of things.
It's
so
a covenant relationship.
Covenant relationship, right.
Doesn't he talk about the church as his bride?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he talks mm-hmm. about the church mm-hmm. being his bride, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And communion is what brings it to us, right?
That's right. So those kind of things are interesting. So here he's talking about the fate of the ungodly, starting with verse 10. Because, but the ungodly will be punished as their reasoning deserves, who disregard the righteous man and rebelled against the Lord. For whoever despises wisdom and instruction is miserable. Their hope is vain, their labors are unprofitable, and their works are useless. Their wives are foolish, and their children are evil. Their offspring are accursed, for blessed is the barren woman who is undefiled, so she hasn't committed sin. So blessed is she who has not entered into a sinful union. So if you're a barren woman, but you're undefiled and haven't committed adultery, you're blessed. Blessed also is the eunuch whose hands have done no lawless deed and who has not devised wicked things against the Lord. For special favor will be shown him for his faithfulness and a place of great delight in the temple of the Lord. For the fruit of good labors is renowned, and the root of understanding does not fail. But children of adulterers will not come to maturity, and the offspring of an unlawful union will perish. We saw that happen to King David, remember? Mm-hmm. His firstborn died that he was conceived in adultery with Bathsheba. Even if they live long, they will be held of no account. And finally, their old age will be without honor. If they die young, they will have no hope and no consolation in the day of decision, for the end of an unrighteous generation is grievous. So he's really talking about the unrighteous people and those kind of, and what's going to happen to them. So he's laying out what a lot of the saints write in their writings too, is that you've got to make a choice. You know, I present you life and death, good and evil. And God gave us free will as a gift, and we have to use that to make the right decisions and live the right life. And if we don't, we suffer the consequences. So how do you...
I got to ask you.
Yes.
Bathsheba is not married to him?
She's going to
wait. His first son was...
Yes. Bathsheba was not married to David when they first committed adultery.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, she was married to Uriah.
And their first son died then?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was the punishment for their adultery.
Sure.
She's got to pass by here.
Oh, my gosh. Stay here.
Dislocated
me.
Oh, yeah. So David, you know, he committed sin, but he had to pay for that sin. And his payment was the loss of his son that was conceived in adultery. And then he had Solomon after he got married to Bathsheba. And Solomon did some of these same things too in his old age. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He had all these 700 wives that were, you know, from these other tribes that worshiped other gods. He started worshiping those gods, and he fell out of favor with God too. So,
I thought it was he allowed them to worship other gods. He allowed the worship. I didn't know he worshiped them too.
Yeah, he fell in too. Mm-hmm. And so he asked God for wisdom, and God gave him great wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
But then he lost it by his behavior.
Infidelity.
He did exactly what they're saying
infidelity.
Not to do here.
Yeah.
In the Book of Wisdom. So then we go to chapter 4, which talks about virtue and descendants. Almost all the great religious writers talk about how important virtue is and how we need to be virtuous in our lives and how we use virtue to fight vice. You know, they say that for every vice, there's an opposing virtue. And if you want to get rid of a vice in your life, you know, you got something you're doing that you don't like, you've got rid of it, they always say, don't try to fight the vice, because then the vice is the thing that's always on your mind. Mm-hmm. Try to increase in the opposing virtue. Mm-hmm. Do everything you can to keep getting more and more virtuous, and the more of virtue you acquire, the less vice you'll have, so the virtue kind of displaces the vice. It's kind of like taking a glass of a light liquid, like water.
I have a question.
Yes.
about what you were talking about. Sorry, it took me so long. I was trying to find the verse to reference. So you're saying that you know, David and Bathsheba's firstborn, you know, son died because he was the fruits of adultery. But in Ezekiel chapter 18, they were talking about, you know, like children aren't responsible for the sins of their father. So why would the child die even though his parents had sinned?
Because it wasn't anything the child did. It was because of what David did. The death of the child was the punishment for David. And it doesn't mean the child, you know, went to hell or anything like that. I mean, he wasn't punishing the child.
Right.
He was punishing David.
But why would the child, like, why would God take an innocent life because of another's sin? Like that, you know what I mean? Like, in terms of just the child. Like, I know that sometimes that can happen, but
death for
purely
the child,
as a result of his adultery, why would he take an innocent life?
Yeah. See, Bonnie, you said, yes.
Death for the child wasn't a punishment.
Right.
I mean, the child probably went to heaven.
Yeah.
Right.
So it wasn't a punishment for the child.
Right.
Right.
Even though people look at it. Yes.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, it was exactly what they were talking about a few minutes ago, if you remember. It's that when somebody dies early, it's looked at as a punishment, but it isn't always.
Right.
You know, and in the case of David's child, that child very well could have been taken right to heaven.
Sure.
Which case to become a saint, you know, and and stuff. But the punishment was for David and Bathsheba because of their adultery.
We grew up learning that sin is in the world, or the things that happen, it's a result of sin in the world. The world's a mess. It's a result of sin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, almost like everything in heaven.
Fatima.
Almost everything bad in the almost everything bad in the world
it's
is because of sin. Right.
Original sin.
And it comes in various forms.
Yeah.
Carol, you had a question? Carol Devine, did you have something you want to say?
I'm listening.
Okay, I thought I saw you. Come on.
Because of original sin, those are two completely
different things. Sure.
Yeah. And that's very
sin.
Interesting
yeah.
what you said, yeah. because that changes the whole look.
Another thing, too.
Yeah.
That changes everything.
Yeah.
I mean, because our sin, we create the issues, you know, and our leadership creates the issues by what they do and do not do.
Comes down, came down.
But original sin, that's something, that's where the consecration of all these countries needs to be done. That's what that's all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that? That's what that's
sure.
all about.
Two separate issues, yeah. Two different thoughts.
Yeah. Well, except all of our sin is rooted in original sin.
Right. That's,
yeah.
But we make the choice to continue it or not. You know?
Yeah, because we have free will.
Right.
We got to use our free will the way God wants us to use it. You know,
we
got to make choices for Him.
Inclination to sin.
We're very aware of our bond with our husband and our wives. You know, we need to be more aware of our bond, the same kind of bond with God. I think.
Right. Yeah.
I think people don't realize.
They don't realize. No.
What that bond is.
Yeah.
Because there's no teachers.
The living Jesus.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you look at the writings of some of the great spiritual writers, you see that.
Right.
Brother Lawrence, a Carmelite monk, was, you know, he wrote a book called The Practice of the Presence of God. And he was just a simple little monk. But it's a really interesting book because his whole spirituality was on being continuously conscious that God is present with you in every single moment of your life. And that it's like he's standing there holding your hand throughout your whole life. So you try to be conscious of that and then live a life that's pleasing to God.
And in the old days, we used to have nuns that, if you told them, taught us that.
God,
but now, unless somebody comes across that book by accident, they don't know.
Right.
That's what I thought you
were
doing.
Yeah.
And so all those things are actually telling us to live a virtuous life. And that's kind of what this next section is about here. And it's talking about... About life, and it's got some notes here on the first six verses of chapter 4. It says, the Jews saw a long life and many offspring as signs of divine favor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, you look at some of the patriarchs that lived to be, you know, a couple of hundred years old and stuff. The Book of Wisdom refines this. A virtuous life is better than having descendants, and premature death can be a sign of God's love. When you're ready, He takes you, and that's kind of a new idea for the Jewish people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, when they saw this in the Book of Wisdom, even though we see it later on in the New Testament, it was a new thing for the Jewish people. Because mm-hmm. the Book of Wisdom refines this: a virtuous life is better than having descendants, and premature death could be a sign of God's love. The author praises virtue. A disposition to act morally. The Greeks held virtue in high regard. Their poets and philosophers heaped praise on it. It consisted in a harmonious blend of moral virtues, which are prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude, and human virtues, which are valor, patience, daring, or courage, keeping one's word, clear-sightedness, etc. The inspired writer proposes this as the ideal way a righteous person should behave. Anyone who wants to develop a mature, well-knit personality really needs to cultivate all the virtues he can. And also be conscious of how the virtues interact with each other and support each other. You know, a good example of that is in Luke's Gospel, where Jesus is at dinner with the Pharisee and the woman off of the street walks in. and starts to wash his feet with her tears and dry them with her hair. She never says a word. And he tells her that your sins are forgiven. You know, and they get, well, how can you say, blah, blah, blah. They go through all this big rigmarole, right? But think of the combination of virtues that this woman of the street had to have to go in and do what she did. First of all, the desire and the love to be near Christ and to seek him. Secondly, to have the courage to crash the house of a Pharisee without being invited.
And humility.
And the humility to sit at the feet of Christ, to wash his feet and dry them. And, you know, all these different virtues came together to for her to be able to do this. And that's what they're talking about here, that the virtues consist of a harmonious blend of moral virtues. So they're talking about this blending. It's not just one. You don't just use one. Usually, it's usually a blend of virtues that will inspire your conduct with any given situation. It says, Christian ascetical writing has beautiful things to say about the way the virtues dovetail. It is impossible to say which one of the forms of virtue is more important than all others. Of course, love is a theological virtue that's superior. That's the only one that lasts when you go to heaven. Or if the practice of one ought to be preferred to that of others, or which one occupies the second place, etc., and how the rest of them should be arranged and ordered, there's nothing that talks about that. They're all important, and they all work together. They are all of equal value, and the practice of some in conjunction with others will lead those who live them to the end to which they aspire. Simplicity opens the way to obedience. Obedience leads to faith. Faith gives rise to hope, and hope inspires justice. Justice engenders a spirit of service, and a spirit of service ends in humility. Meekness of heart, which grows with humility, brings joy. Joy is the way to love, and love is prayer. In this way, the virtues, each one bound up with all, come together in the person who possesses them and leads the soul to the height of what it desires. And that's St. Gregory of Nyssa's letter on part of the Book of Wisdom.
What do you think simplicity is? That was the first one mentioned that led to obedience. What is simplicity?
That doesn't mean simple-minded, okay? Simplicity, just keep it everything you know, clear. You don't get everything all complicated.
Oh, okay.
The more complicated you make things, the harder. God never does things in a complicated way. Okay. Everything Jesus ever did was very straightforward. Everything he said, he uses a tremendous economy of words. You know, you got to really pay attention to the words he uses. When you read the Gospels, because it's economy of words, but every single word is important. Simplicity.
Like
right.
He summed up the Ten Commandments, yeah. Love God and love neighbor.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's good.
That's an example of simplicity, taking all the law and all the commandments and boiling it down to those two commandments of love. Yeah, so simplicity opens the way to if you keep it simple, then you understand what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it says it leads to obedience. What does Jesus say in John 14:23? Mm-hmm. You know, if you love me, you will keep my word. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, then the Father will love you, and we will come and make our dwelling in you. The idea of the indwelling Trinity. Okay? It's very important. So St. Gregory is talking about this here. And then the next note says, immortality, the reward for virtue, is not just a matter of one's memory living on. God is the first to remember virtue, and then men. Virtue will have its reward in eternity, where it will be given its well-deserved crown. And if you remember in the Book of Revelation, it talks about the crowns that the martyrs have and stuff like that. No such reward for the ungodly. Any fruit they produce will be impermanent and useless. This failure in life signals their spiritual and eternal ruin, their spiritual and eternal ruin. Their lives will be taken from the root, and they will be condemned at the last judgment. So all through this book in this section. There's a lot of eschatological overtones to the whole thing.
Brings up a lot of questions, though.
Huh?
It brings up a lot of questions.
It does bring up a lot of questions, yes. And it's got a lot of good advice. So let's take a look at chapter 4 here. It says, better than this, a virtue and a sense. Better than this is childlessness with virtue. For in the memory of virtue is immortality, because it is known both by God and by men. When it is present, men imitate it, and they long for it when it is gone. That's a really important statement right there, because it says, when it is present, men imitate it. If you are acting virtuously, and people around you, you know, are your normal companions, and they see that, they're going to start imitating it. And you see it in little subtle ways. You know, when I was teaching at Fort Belvoir, we had a fellow in my department that was also supposed to be Catholic, and he was always running into my office and throwing F-bombs out every other word, you know. And I never responded that way. I didn't chastise him for it, but instead, I acted a totally different way. And after a short amount of time, he'd come in and never do that anymore. You know, so he was changing because he was imitating what I was doing instead of what he was doing. And I'm sure he was inspired by his angel and by God and everything else to do that. But you know, people are going to imitate you, which means you have a responsibility to them to live a virtuous life. You can't live a non-virtuous life and then tell other people that they should live virtuously. You know, you've got to be the example as well as the teacher.
And choose virtuous people to be with.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Or help
my
people.
My grandmother
who,
used to say, tell
yeah.
me with
choose,
whom
choose
you
your
go,
companions,
I'll
yeah.
tell you what you are.
Mm-hmm.
But also
so.
Give example to those who are not virtuous
right.
so they can become virtuous. You know, it works both ways.
Right.
Okay. And they long for it when it is gone. When you're around somebody and you're virtuous, when you leave, they long for that. They want that virtue around all the time. And throughout all time, it marches crowded in triumph, crowned in triumph. Victor in the contest for prizes that are undefiled. The virtue leads you to your reward in heaven, living a virtuous life. But the prolific brood of the ungodly will be of no use, and none of their illegitimate seedlings will strike a deep root or take a firm hold. For even as they put forth boughs for a while, standing insecurely, they will be shaken by the wind, and by the violence of the winds they will be uprooted. When I read that, I couldn't help but think what Jesus talked about, a house built on sand.
Mm.
You know, just to me, the same idea came through, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a good foundation
mm-hmm.
and you're virtuous, you'll stand, resist temptations of Satan and those kinds of things. The branches will be broken off before they come to maturity, and their fruit will be useless, not ripe enough to eat, and good for nothing. What does Jesus tell us? You've been known by your fruit. You bear. For children born of unlawful unions are witnesses of evil against their parents when God examines them. So when God judges you at the final judgment and you are the result of unlawful unions, you're standing there as a witness against that unlawful union. Doesn't mean he's going to punish you, okay? Because you had nothing to do with it. It was just something besides. You had no choice in the matter.
So a lawless union constitutes two married people or a married person and an unmarried person?
Either one.
Just
or two unmarried people.
Unless they get adopted.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I have to say that because my daughter is
right.
Yeah, because it could be two unmarried people. Because St. Paul says that the fornicators cannot enter heaven. So it could be any kind of immoral
union.
Or it could be guy on guy and girl on girl.
They wouldn't make a baby, though.
But they won't make a baby, that's right. That's like, kind of hard for
except
that.
By artificial.
This is very true. This is very
or
true.
Or by somebody else.
Right.
Exactly.
And then he goes into the idea of premature death, which is one of the first times in the Old Testament they really talk about the about how a premature death is not necessarily a bad thing, because they always held, you know, lots of kids in a long age as a big virtue. And they have some notes here on that section. It says, the approach taken in the Book of Wisdom is different from that of ordinary Jewish tradition, and it comes up with new answers to old questions. For example, to live into old age was considered a sign of divine favor, and an early death was seen as a misfortune and a punishment. But here, a more nuanced approach is taken. Longevity is not a matter of having a long life, but of having lived with wisdom and prudence, and of leading a blameless life. In this context, premature death is far from being a punishment, is a sign of God's love, that he should reward the soul early and save him from affliction and grief. And then says St. Jerome, writing about this section of the Book of Wisdom, uses these verses to console an afflicted soul. He said, yes, we weep for the dead, but only those who have tumbled down into Gehenna, who are burned up in the fire, the ones for whom the fire was enkindled. When we leave this life, however, we will be accompanied by a great host of angels, and Christ himself will come out to meet us. We should be sad if our lives in this earthly tomb were to go on for too long. So that's St. Jerome's epistle number 39, where he's talking about this section of the Book of Wisdom. So it says, premature death is a joy to the righteous, but the righteous man, though he die early, will be at rest. For old age is not honored for length of time, nor measured by number of years, but understanding is gray hair for men, and a blameless life is ripe old age. So they're equating understanding, you know, wisdom, and a blameless life being equivalent to a gray hair and old age. Because they say you acquire wisdom with age. Well, if you get wisdom early, you don't have to live forever, you know? You can just go to heaven early.
I'm still
going
to go.
How much longer?
So this is one of the first places we see where this idea of an early death not being a curse in Jewish literature comes in. So there was one who, next point says, there was one who pleased God and was loved by him. And while living among sinners, he was taken up. He was caught up lest evil change his understanding or guile deceive his soul. For the fascination of wickedness obscures what is good. That's an important line there, too. The fascination of wickedness obscures what is good.
Our world today.
Oh, yeah. Nobody ever goes out of their way to do what they believe is not good. There's always some rationale given to us by Satan, oftentimes, to try to convince us that what we're about to do is a good. You know, a bank robber walks in. You know, robbing a bank is bad. You might hurt somebody in the process. The money isn't yours. You've got no right to it. You're violating the Ten Commandments that says do not steal. But but he has to be convinced that it's a good. So in his mind, getting all that money is good. Think of all the good things he's going to be able to do with all that money.
Yeah.
You know, so he's got to rationalize to a good in order to perform that act.
Yeah.
And that's what they're talking about here. The fascination of wickedness obscures what is good.
I'm thinking of all the DAs that they put in all over the country and who don't enforce the laws.
Yeah.
To give the criminals...
Yeah.
More compassion than the victims. They put them in, they arrest them, and they're out the next day doing the same crime again. Do they believe they're doing good? I still don't understand. I
well, they call it social justice. So in their minds, it is a kind of a good, but it's a kind of a misdirected good.
Right.
Okay. But that idea that nobody goes out of their way to do what they think is bad, They do what to them, through some rationalization process, seems to be a good. At least for them, anyway. Mm-hmm. Maybe
that's
not for anybody else.
Even about a prostitute, he has to look at her as good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And a roving desire perverts the innocent mind. A lot of that going on, right? Being perfected in a short, being perfected in a short time, he fulfills long years. For his soul was pleasing to the Lord. Therefore, he took him quickly from the midst of wickedness. Yet the people saw and did not understand, nor take such a thing to heart, that God's grace and mercy are with his elect, and he watches over his holy ones. The righteous man who had died will condemn the ungodly who are living. Again, it goes back to that idea that the saints will judge the tribes, you know, of Israel. We see this in Revelation, among the elders and the apostles and stuff like that. So he's saying those who live righteously will be there at that judgment. And youth that is quickly perfected will condemn the prolonged old age of the unrighteous man. It's better to be young and righteous and then go to heaven than to live a long old age if you're unrighteous, because it doesn't do you any good. And then he goes into the sorry end of the ungodly. And that's verses 17 through 20. They have a little short note about that. It says, for the third time, the author speaks about the death of the foolish as against that of the just. Using biblical language, he says that God will laugh at the ungodly. No glory for them. Their bodies will become corpses, and even the dead will scorn them. The just will be at peace, but the ungodly will be filled with dread when they are indicted for their sins. When I saw that one line, it said the Lord will laugh them to scorn, I said, why? God doesn't do that. He wants your conversion. He doesn't laugh at you when you do. But that was an idea that was not foreign to Jewish literature. If you look at the Psalms, you see that at least three times in the Psalms. Psalm 2, verse 4, talks about God laughing, you know, at the ungodly or the enemies. Psalm 37, verse 13, and Psalm 59, verse 8. 59, verse 8. So there's references there in the Psalms of God laughing. But what do we really know from the writings of the saints? That God doesn't laugh at people who are ungodly. He wants their conversion. He doesn't want their condemnation. He tells us in the gospel that hell was created for Satan and the fallen angels. It wasn't created for man. We have to choose to go there by the way we live our lives.
Now, and so, I have a question here.
Yeah.
In that thought, then back up a little bit with the trying to find the right behavior and everything, and you know, people are in situations where they have in their lives made, you know, bad decisions sometimes.
Sure.
But
I think everybody's made a bad decision sometime.
Right? But you try to work with that,
right,
and make good decisions from that, having learned,
right,
you know, not to make,
right,
bad decisions from that. But you try to keep it, you know, as good as you can, and then other people are involved in your life, and sometimes they do things that, you know, affect your life.
They can, yeah,
like,
sure.
For instance, in divorce.
Yeah.
Sometimes the husband or the wife, one of them doesn't want the divorce, but they have the divorce anyway because the other person gave them the divorce.
They can actually demand it.
Yeah.
In a no-fault divorce, right?
Yeah. And and so that leaves that person in a very difficult situation,
yeah,
and the church rejects them. Because they've been divorced, they're not allowed to go to communion.
No, they're not. That's not true.
You can go to communion.
That's true.
You don't remember if you can go to communion.
Well, yeah.
A person who's divorced can go to communion,
yes,
and go to Mass. They cannot do so if they get married again.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if this person would be better off, if they're going to have a problem with being unmarried, and they would sin, they know in their heart that they would sin more I mean, actually, in all reality, too, if they've got a bond with Jesus, I mean, once you've received communion once, you have that bond.
Right.
So they don't really need to.
Once you've been baptized, you've got that bond.
Well, you have more of a bond with the communion,
yeah. Right? Right, sure.
And, you know, I mean, if their choice is to be baptized, if they're a baby, it's not the same, but...
Right.
If they choose the baptism, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
They usually receive communion then, too, right?
Right.
But, it frustrates me to think about this, about how this affects these people, because in my thoughts, they're doing the best they can. Are they going to be condemned for that? It doesn't seem right, you know? And so they have to choose to move away from the Catholic Church if they want to.
When you say condemned, you're basically saying somebody has gone to hell, right?
Well, but in the eyes of the Church, if they go to communion, I mean, after they... If they marry someone after they're divorced, then they're right, isn't that? They're condemned.
Yeah.
So to me, that.
But what do you have to have? What do you have to have to have mortal? What do you have to have mortal sin?
I don't really know.
And St. John tells us in his letters that they're, you know, he said if you sin, ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
But he also says that there is some sin that is deadly.
Yeah.
That we call it mortal sin. Yeah. He said just asking for forgiveness, you know, praying to God. Doesn't cut it.
Yeah.
That's why Jesus gave us the sacrament of confession.
Yeah.
Because you have to go out of your way to an ordained priest to receive absolution for that sin, or have perfect contrition. Perfect contrition would also take away mortal sin. Perfect contrition means you do it. You are sorry. You've offended God because you love Him so much, not because you're afraid of going to hell. Okay. Perfect contrition is not always an easy thing to do when somebody doesn't have a good relationship with God to begin with. Okay? But God always judges the heart.
Yeah.
And it's not our job to judge the heart. We can look at their actions and say their actions are not good, but it's not our place to judge the heart of anybody. That's God's.
Yeah.
Now, we don't know anybody who has gone to hell other than Judas.
But objectively, don't they need an annulment to go to communion? And can't the person that was wronged, who didn't want the divorce, get an annulment?
Sometimes they say they can't have an annulment.
Getting a divorce doesn't do anything as far as you go on a mass communion.
You're talking about remarrying.
Yeah,
if you get remarried, right. That's where the problem is.
In their lives, they, you know.
Because
that's why I'm talking about annulments. So
but annulments aren't always granted.
It is. It's more difficult some places.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's more difficult.
In Texas, they gave one to everybody.
Yeah. I think they thought about it.
Do they all have to go through the Pope, though?
No.
It's a
council kind of that judges and it steps. And in Texas, they didn't want those people to be out of the church, so they were very...
Because they'll go somewhere else. You know, if they're people who want... I mean, they're asking for an annulment for a reason, because they want that relationship with God. They want that closeness.
Right.
But what does
annulment mean? There was no marriage.
Right. But you got to understand what annulment means.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same thing as divorce.
Right. No. Yeah,
okay.
I understand.
Annulment means that at the time the marriage was entered into, it could not be sacramental.
Because of inability to maintain a permanent commitment. And I'm always thinking, how many 20-year-olds do?
Well, there are a lot of different reasons.
Yeah.
You know? But there has to be a finding that the original marriage was not sacramental.
But I think they're much stricter here than they are. But we were military, so there was a big difference.
That could be.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, that's a judgment that has to be made.
Right, right. I agree.
See, then, though, there's that, I don't know where it is, but your word will be law. I don't know where that, you know what I'm talking about.
Right, right. But we were engaged.
And it's like, they say a lot of things in the church that some of them are kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm. Kind of tough.
It's hard. It's hard.
I don't know if I agree with some of them.
Well.
You know?
Well, we don't. Have to agree with
it. Exactly.
We have to live by it.
But if there's situations where there's a lot of things going on in the church. What if our government took over our religion? What if the government stepped in and took over the Catholic Church and told the Pope, you're going to do this? What would we do? How would we handle that?
I'd laugh.
You'd laugh.
I'd laugh.
But what if the Pope came out and said what they told us to do, what they said to do? You'd have to do
you don't,
it again.
You don't, no, you wouldn't.
No, you would not.
You only have to follow the Pope when he teaches infallibly in matters of faith and morals.
What if you don't know when that's happening? What if you don't know?
He makes it. He has to make it explicit. He has
you ask the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
The Holy Spirit guiding you
to somebody.
That's never going
to
happen anyway, because Jesus promised that the Holy Spirit would be with the church until the end of time.
That's very true. Right.
So, that's not something we got to worry
about.
Complex. You know?
That's a great relief right there.
That's right.
Thought.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
that's
let's
thing.
Get back to verse 17 here.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. No problem. That's what we're here for.
That's such a common question.
That's why what we have is a discussion, not a lecture.
Do you need to get in?
That's why what we have is a discussion, not a lecture.
Thanks.
This is for,
appreciate it.
He's talking about the sorry end of the ungodly. What's going to happen to these ungodly people? So they will see the end of the wise man.
Are we in the Bible again, or are you commentary?
Okay. It says, the sorry end of the ungodly, for they will see the end of the wise man, and will not understand what the Lord purposed for him, and for what he kept him safe. They will see and will have contempt for him, but the Lord will laugh them to scorn. After this, they will become dishonored corpses, and an outrage among the dead forever, because he will dash them speechless to the ground and shake them from the foundations. They will be left utterly dry and barren, and they will suffer anguish, and the memory of them will perish. They will come with dread when their sins are reckoned up, and their lawless deeds will convict them to their face. It says the memory of them will perish. Jesus talks about that in the Gospels. You remember the passage where, I think it's in Matthew, I don't remember. He's talking about the last judgment. And he's talking about their come up, you know, God is judging the people, you know. And he goes through an initial scenario, and then he says, I do not know you. I do not know you. That is the most dreaded thing you could ever hear from God.
Terrible.
I do not know you. Because how's he going to recognize you? He's going to recognize you by how much you have Jesus in your heart, in your soul. If he's not there, he's not going to recognize you. And if he doesn't recognize you, then what does that tell you?
You're in trouble.
Well, about us when we go to heaven, you know. Suppose you're living a good life, and you're righteous, and you go to heaven, but you have a child. You love that child because it's your child, and that child goes the opposite way, ends up going to hell. How can you be happy in heaven, knowing your child that you love is in hell?
You did not know him. You must give us that.
Will you forget that child? It's just wiped out.
I don't know, but I can't think of any other. I can't think of any other way God will protect you from that sorrow.
I think our moms taught us: pray for your kids. Pray for your kids.
That's
a lot.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Because you know, I don't know. I've never seen anything written or anything else, but I can't think of anything other than that that would have to happen in order for us to be truly sublimely happy in heaven, knowing our child is in hell. You know, that would be hard, I think. So,
but another thing too is we are responsible for consolation
of the saints when you've done everything you could have done.
Yeah.
And then that's between you and Jesus in the final judgment, where he tells you, my daughter, I saw everything that you did. I saw the effort, the earnest love that you put out, but your child chose otherwise. Free will.
Free will, that's right.
Responsibility.
That's right.
And we love God more. We should be loving God more than even our children.
So pray for your children.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good reason. It's 10:35. We are 5 minutes over our time. It's time to
go on.
To go. So, does anybody have any final comments before we close for today and pick up with chapter 5 next time?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Alan.
Thank you.
Good to have you on.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you, Jen.
Right. Thank you for joining us, Eleanor. We're glad to have you. He didn't say a word.
He didn't say a word.
He didn't say a word the whole time.
Well, yeah, he's taking his time. Hopefully, yeah. He'll